Chapter 34. Crozier. Latitude 69 degrees, 37 minutes, 42 seconds north. Longitude 98 degrees, 41 minutes west. 22 April, 1848. Pulling toward the Arctic sunset, Captain Crozier knew the mathematics of this purgatory. 8 miles this first day on the ice to Sea Camp 1. 9 miles the next, if all went well, ending in a midnight arrival at Sea Camp 2. 8 miles, including some of the hardest going near the coast, where the sledges had to be hauled up over the barrier where pack ice met coastal ice, the third and final day. And there, the tentative safe haven of Terror Camp. Both crews would be together for the first time. If Crozier's sledge teams survived this ice crossing and kept ahead of the thing following them on the ice, all 105 men would be together on the wind-scoured northwestern coast of the island. The early sledge trips to King William Land in March, most of them in darkness, had made such slow going that often the men with their sledges had camped the first night on the ice within sight of the ship. One day, with a storm blowing in their faces out of the southeast, Lieutenant Le Vicomte had made less than a mile after 12 hours of constant effort. But it was much easier in the sunlight, with the sledge trail laid down and the path through pressure ridges reduced in difficulty, if not actually levelled. Crozier had not wanted to end up on King William Land. His visits to Victory Point had not convinced him, despite the huge dump of food and gear there and the preparation of tent circles, that the men could survive there for long. The weather blowing almost always out of the northwest was murderous in winter, atrocious in the spring and brief autumn, and life-threatening during the summer. The late Lieutenant Gore's experience of wild lightning storms during the first visit to the landmass in the summer of 1847 had been repeated again and again that summer and early autumn. One of the first things Crozier authorized hauling to land the previous summer had been the ship's extra lightning rods, along with brass curtain rods from Sir John's quarters to Jury Rig Moor. Right up until the crushing of Erebus on the last day of March, Crozier had hopes that they could set off for the east coast of the Boothia Peninsula, the possible stores there at Fury Beach, and the probable sighting by whalers coming in from Baffin Bay. Like old John Ross, they could hike or boat north along the east coast of Boothia up to Somerset Island, or even Devon Island again if they had to. Sooner or later they would spy a ship in Lancaster Sound. And there were Eskimo villages in that direction. Crozier knew this for a fact. He'd seen them on his first voyage to the Arctic with William Edward Parry in 1819 when he was 22. He'd returned to the area again with Parry 2 years later in a quest to find the passage, and again 2 years after that, still searching for the Northwest Passage, a search that would kill Sir John Franklin 26 years later. "And might yet kill us all," thought Crozier, and shook his head to get the defeatist thought out of it. The sun was very close to the southern horizon. Just before it set, they would stop and eat a cold dinner. Then they would harness up again and walk another 6 to 8 hours through the deep afternoon, evening, and nighttime darkness to reach Sea Camp 1, a little more than a third of the way to King William Land and Terror Camp. There was no sound now, except for the panting of the men, the creak of leather, and the rasp of runners. The wind had died completely, but the air was even colder with the dimming of the twilight afternoon sun. Ice crystals of breath hung above the procession of men and sledges like slowly collapsing spheres of gold. Walking near the front of the line now, as they approached the tall pressure ridge, ready to help with the initial pulling and lifting and shoving and soft cursing, Crozier looked toward the setting sun and thought of how hard he had tried to find a way to Boothia and the whalers from Baffin Bay. At age 31, Crozier had accompanied Captain Parry into those Arctic waters a fourth and final time, this time to reach the North Pole. They'd accomplished a farthest north record that easily stood until this day, but had eventually been stopped by solid pack ice that stretched to the northern limits of the world. Francis Crozier no longer believed in the open polar sea. When someone finally reached the pole, he was sure they'd be doing it by sledge. Perhaps by sleds pulled by dogs, the way the Eskimo preferred to travel. Crozier had seen the natives and their light sleds, not real sledges at all by Royal Navy standards, but only flimsy little sleds, sliding along behind those strange dogs of theirs in Greenland and along the east side of Somerset Island. They moved much faster than Crozier's team ever could with this man-hauling. But most central to his plan to head east, if at all possible, was the fact that the Eskimo were out there to the east, somewhere at Boothia or beyond. And like Lady Silence, whom they had seen going ahead to Terror Camp, following Lieutenants Hodgson's and Irving's sledge teams earlier that week, these natives knew how to hunt and fish for themselves in this godforsaken white world. After Irving reported to him way back in early February about the young lieutenant's difficulties in following Lady Silence, or communicating with her about where and how she got the seal meat and fish Irving swore he had seen her with, Crozier contemplated threatening the girl's life with pistol or boat knife to make her show them how she found the fresh food. But in his heart, he'd known how such a threat would end up. The Eskimo wench's tongueless mouth would stay firmly shut, and her huge dark eyes would stare unblinkingly at Crozier and his men until he had to back down or make good on his threat. Nothing would be accomplished. So he'd left her out in her little snow house, Irving had described to him, and allowed Mr. Diggle to give her the occasional biscuit or scrap. The captain had tried to put her out of his mind. That he had been shocked to be reminded she was still alive when the lookout reported her following a few hundred yards behind Hodgson's and Irving's relay trip to Terror Camp last week showed Crozier that he had succeeded in not thinking about the wench, but he knew he still dreamed about her. If Crozier were not so very, very tired, he might have taken some small pride in the design and durability of the various sledges that the men were now man-hauling southeast across the ice. In mid-March, even before it was certain that Erebus would break up from the rising pressure, he had Mr. Honey, the expedition's surviving carpenter, and his mates, Wilson and Watson, working day and night to design and build sledges that could haul the ship's boats as well as gear. As soon as the first prototype larger oak and brass sledges were finished that spring, Crozier had the men out on the ice, testing them and learning the best ways to haul them. He had the riggers and quartermasters, and even the four topmen, constantly fiddling with the design of the harnesses to give the men the best pulling leverage with the least interruption of their movement and breathing. By mid-March, the sledge designs were set. More were being built, and it seemed that a design of harnesses for 11 men for the large sledges carrying boats and 7 men for the smaller supply sledges would be best. This was for the initial supply crossings to Terror Camp on King William Land. If they took to the ice after that, Crozier knew, with some of the men too sick to pull, and perhaps others dead by then, 18 boats and sledges, each loaded to the gunwales with survival rations and gear, requiring man-hauling by 100 men or fewer, it would mean fewer than 11 men pulling each burden. More work, and even heavier loads for men, who presumably would be deeper in the pit of scurvy and exhaustion by then. By the last week in March, even as Erebus was in her death throes, both crews were out on the ice in darkness and the brief sunlight, competing in man-hauling contests with the different sledges, finding the right match of men to sledge, learning the right techniques, and putting together the best teams composed of men from both ships and all ranks. They were competing for cash, silver and gold, and even though Sir John had planned to buy many souvenirs in Alaska, Russia, the Orient, and the Sandwich Islands, and there were chests of shillings and guineas in the dead man's private storeroom, these coins came out of Francis Crozier's pocket. Crozier wanted badly to head toward Baffin Bay as soon as the days grew long enough to support long-distance sledging. He knew instinctively, and from listening to Sir John's tales, and from reading George Back's history of ascending more than 650 miles of the Back's Great Fish River to Great Slave Lake 14 years ago, the volume was in Terra's library, and now in Crozier's personal pack on one of the sledges, that the odds of any of them finishing or surviving the trip were low. The 160-some miles between Terra's position off King William Land and the mouth of Great Fish River might not be traversable, even as a prelude to the arduous voyage up the river. It combined the worst of coastal ice with threats of open leads that could make them abandon the sledges and, even if there were no leads, the assured agony of hauling sledges and boats across the frozen gravel of the island itself, all while exposed to the worst of the pack ice storms. Once on the river, if they ever reached the river, they would be confronted with what Back had described as a violent and tortuous course of 530 geographical miles, running through an iron-ribbed country without a single tree on the whole of its banks. And then, no fewer than 83 falls, cascades, and rapids. Crozier had trouble imagining his men, after another month or more of man-hauling, being fit enough or well enough to confront 83 falls, cascades, and rapids in even the sturdiest boats. The portages alone would kill them. A week earlier, before heading out with the boat sledge teams to Terra Camp, Surgeon Goodsir told Crozier that the lemon juice antisorbutic, their only defense against scurvy now, as weak as it had become, would run out in 3 weeks or less, depending upon how many men died between now and then. Crozier knew how quickly the full onslaught of scurvy would weaken all of them. For this 25 miles to King William Land, with light sledges and full teams on full rations for the crossing, on a runner's path that had been beaten into the ice for more than a month, they had to cover a little more than 8 miles a day. On the rough terrain or coastal ice of King William Land and south, that distance might be cut in half, or worse. Once the scurvy began having its way with them, they might only cover a mile a day, and if the wind died, might well not be able to pole or paddle the heavy boats upstream against the current of Back's River. A portage of any distance in the weeks or months to come might soon become impossible. The only things working in their favour in heading south were the very long-shot chance that a rescue party was already heading north from Great Slave Lake, searching for them, and the simple fact that it would be getting warmer as they travelled farther south. They would be following the thaw at the very least. Still, Crozier would have preferred staying in the northern latitudes and going the longer distance east and north to Boothia Peninsula and then across it. He knew there was only one, even relatively safe way to attempt that. Take the men to King William Land, cross it, and then make the relatively short traverse across open ice, sheltered from the worst of the northwest wind and weather by the island itself to the southwestern coast of the Boothia, then slowly north along the edge of the ice or on the coastal plain itself, and finally across the mountains toward Fury Bay, hoping every step of the way to meet Eskimo. It was the safe way, but it was the long way. 1,200 miles, almost half again longer than the alternate route south around King William Land, and then further south up Back's River. Unless they met friendly Eskimo soon after crossing to the Boothia, they would all be dead weeks or months before such a 1,200-mile trip could be completed. Even so, Francis Crozier would have preferred to have wagered everything on a dash straight across the ice, northeast over the worst of the pack ice, in a mad attempt to replicate the astounding 600-mile small group sledge trip made by his friend James Clark Ross 18 years earlier, when the Fury was frozen in on the opposite side of the Boothia Peninsula. The old steward, Bridgens, had been absolutely correct. John Ross had taken the best bet on survival, forcing his way north by foot and sledge, and then in boats left behind up to Lancaster Sound and waiting for whalers. And his nephew, James Ross, showed that it was possible, just possible, to sledge from King William Land back to Fury Beach. Erebus was still in its final 10 days of agony when Crozier had detached the best man-haulers from each ship, the winners of the biggest prizes, and the last money Francis Crozier had in the world, given them the best designed sledge, and ordered Mr. Helpman and Mr. Osmer, the purser, to fit this super team of man-haulers out with everything they might need for 6 weeks on the ice. It was an 11-man sledge, headed by Erebus second mate Charles Frederick DeVoe, its lead puller the giant Manson. Each of the other 9 men were asked to volunteer. Each man did. Crozier had to know if it was possible to man-haul a fully loaded boat sledge across the open ice in such a straight dash toward rescue. The 11 men left at 6 bells on 23 March in the dark, with the temperature at 38 below zero, to 3 rousing cheers from every ambulatory crewman assembled from both ships. DeVoe and his men were back in 3 weeks. No one had died, but they were all exhausted, and four of the men had serious frostbite. Magnus Manson was the only one of the 11-man team, including the apparently indefatigable DeVoe, who did not seem close to death from exhaustion and hardship. In 3 weeks, they had been able to travel less than 28 miles in a straight line from Terra and Erebus. DeVoe later estimated that they had manhauled more than 150 miles to gain those 28, but there was no possibility of traveling in a straight line that far out on the pack ice. The weather northeast of their current position was more terrible than the ninth circle of hell where they had been trapped for 2 years. Pressure ridges were legion. Some rose to heights greater than 80 feet. Even steering their course was close to impossible when clouds hid the southerly sun and the stars were hidden for several 18-hour nights on end. Compasses, of course, were useless this close to the North Magnetic Pole. The team had brought 5 tents for safety's sake, although they had planned to sleep in only 2 of them. The nights were so cold out on the exposed ice that the 11 men slept the last 9 nights, when they were able to sleep at all, in a single tent. But in the end, they'd had no choice in the matter, since 4 of the sturdy tents had blown away or been ripped to shreds by the 12th night on the ice. Somehow, DeVoe had kept them moving to the northeast, but every day the weather worsened, the pressure ridges grew closer together, the necessary deviations from their course became longer and more treacherous, and the sledge sustained serious damage in their Herculean struggle to haul and shove it over the jagged ice ridges. 2 days were lost just repairing the sledge in the howl of wind and blowing snow. The mate had decided to turn around on their 14th morning on the ice. With only 1 tent left, he gauged their chances of survival as low. They then tried to follow their own 13 days of ruts back to the ships, but the ice was too active, shifting slabs, moving bergs within the pack ice, and new pressure ridges rising in front of them had obliterated their track. DeVoe, the finest navigator on the Franklin expedition, except for Crozier, took theodolite and sextant readings in the few clear moments he found in the days and nights, but ended up setting his course based mostly on dead reckoning. He told the men that he knew precisely where they were. He was sure, he later admitted to Fitzjames and Crozier, that he would miss the ships by 20 miles. On their last night on the ice, the final tent ripped, and they abandoned their sleeping bags and pressed on to the southwest blindly, manhauling just to stay alive. They jettisoned their extra food and clothing, continuing to manhaul the sledge only because they needed their water, shotguns, cartridges, and powder. Something large had been following them for the entire voyage. They could see it through the spindrift and fog and pelting hail. They could hear it circling them each endless night in the darkness. DeVoe and his men were sighted on the northern horizon, still headed due west and oblivious of terror 3 miles south of them on the morning of their 21st day on the ice. An Erebus lookout had spotted them, but the ship itself was gone by then, crushed and splintered and sunk. It was DeVoe's and his men's good fortune that the lookout, Icemaster James Reed, had climbed the huge iceberg that had been part of the Grand Venetian Carnival before dawn that day and spotted the men through his glass just at first light. Reed, Lieutenant Le Vicomte, Surgeon Goodsir, and Harry Pegler led the party that went out to fetch the DeVoe team, bringing them back past the crushed timbers, tumbled masts, and tangled rigging that was all that remained of the sunken ship. 5 of the DeVoe champion team were not able to walk the last mile to Terra, but had to be sledged there by their mates. The 6 Erebuses among the super team of sledgers, including DeVoe, wept at the sight of their destroyed home as they were led past it. So, the short way northeast to Boothia was no longer an option. After debriefing DeVoe and the other shattered men, both Fitzjames and Crozier agreed that a few of the 105 survivors might make it to Boothia, but the vast majority were certain to perish on the ice under such conditions, even with the longer days, slightly rising temperatures and added sunlight. The possibility of open leads would only add to the hazard. The choices now were either stay on the ships or set up a camp on King William Land, with the option of making a run south to Back's River. Crozier began the planning for the evacuation the next day. Just before sunset and their dinner stop, the procession of sledges came across a hole in the ice. They stopped, the five sledges and harnessed men making a ring around the pit. The black circle far below them was the first open water the men had seen in 20 months.
"This weren't here last week when we brung the pinnaces to Terror Camp, Captain," said Seaman Thomas Tadman. "You can see how close them runner tracks come to it. We would have seen it, sure, like. There was nothing here."
Crozier nodded. This was no ordinary polynya, the Russian word for one of those rare holes in pack ice that remained open all year long. The ice was more than 10 feet thick here, less thick than the congealed pack ice around Terra, but still solid enough to erect a London building on. But there was no sign of pressure slabs or cracking around this hole. It was as if someone or something had taken a gigantic ice saw, of the sort both ships packed, and cut a perfectly round hole through the ice. But the ship's ice saws would not cut so cleanly through 10 feet of ice.
"We could take our dinner here," said Thomas Blanky. "Enjoy our victuals by the seaside, as it were."
The men shook their heads. Crozier agreed. He wondered if the others felt the same unease he did about the uncannily perfect circle, deep pit, and black water.
"We'll keep moving for another hour or so," he said. "Lieutenant Little, have your sledge take the lead, please."
It was perhaps 20 minutes later. The sun had set with an almost tropical suddenness, and stars were shaking and twitching in the cold sky when Privates Hopcraft and Pilkington, who had been serving as rear guard, crunched up to Crozier, where he was walking beside the rearmost sledge. Hopcraft whispered,
"Captain, there's something following us."
Crozier pulled his brass telescope from the top-lashed box on the sled and stood stationary on the ice with the two men for a minute while the sledges rasped their way past them into the gathering gloom.
"There, sir," said Pilkington, pointing with his good arm. "Maybe it come up out of that hole in the ice, Captain. Do you think it did? Bobby and I think it probably did. Maybe it was just down there in the black water, under the ice, waiting for us to pass and then come up for us, or hoping for us to tarry there. Do you think, sir?"
Crozier did not answer. He could see it through the glass, just visible in the failing light. It looked white, but only because it was briefly silhouetted against storm clouds building in the night black sky to the northwest. As the thing passed seracs and ice boulders, the sledge procession had grunted its way past only 20 minutes earlier. It was easier to get a sense of its enormous size. At the shoulder, even when it was moving on all fours as it was now, it was taller than Magnus Manson. It moved lithely for something so massive. The movement looked to be more fox-like than bear-heavy. As Crozier struggled to steady the glass in the rising wind, he saw the thing rise up and begin walking on two legs. It moved a little less rapidly that way, but still more quickly than men attached 2,000-pound sledges. It now towered over seracs, whose tops Crozier could not have reached with his fully raised arm and extended telescope. Then it was dark, and he could no longer make it out against the background of pressure ridges and seracs. He led the Marines back to the sledge procession and set his glass into the storage box as the men ahead leaned steeply into their harnesses and grunted and panted and pulled.
"Stay close to the sledges, but keep looking rearward and keep your weapons primed," he said softly to Pilkington and Hopcraft. "No lanterns. You'll need whatever vision you have in the dark."
The bulky shapes of the Marines nodded and moved rearward. Crozier noted that the guards ahead of the first sledge had lit their lanterns. He could no longer see the men, just the ice crystal haloed circles of light. The captain called Thomas Blanky over. The man's peg leg and wooden foot exempted him from man-hauling, even though the foot had been thoughtfully studded with nails and cleats for the ice. The half leg simply didn't give Blanky the leverage and pulling power he needed. But the men knew that the ice master might soon figuratively, if not literally, pull his weight and more. Knowledge of ice conditions would be crucial if they encountered leads and had to launch their boats from Terror Camp in the coming weeks or months. Now Crozier used Blanky as a messenger.
"Mr. Blanky, would you be so good as to go forward and pass the word to the men not hauling that we will not be stopping for supper? they should retrieve the cold beef and biscuits from the appropriate sledge boxes and pass them out to the Marines and men in harness, along with the word that everyone should eat on the march and drink from the water bottles they carry under their outer clothing. And also, please ask our guards to make sure that their weapons are ready. They might wish to remove their outer mittens.
Yes, Captain, said Blanky,
and disappeared ahead into the gloom. Crozier could hear the crunch of his hobnailed wooden foot. The captain knew that within 10 minutes, every man on the march would understand that the thing on the ice was following them and closing the gap.
Chapter 35. Irving. Latitude 69 degrees, 37 minutes, 42 seconds north. Longitude 98 degrees, 40 minutes, 58 seconds west. 24 April, 1848. Except for the fact that John Irving was sick and half starving and his gums were bleeding and he feared that two of his side teeth were loose and he was so tired that he was afraid he would collapse in his tracks at any moment, this was one of the happiest days of his life. All this day and the previous day, he and George Henry Hodgson, old friends from the gunnery training ship Excellent before this expedition, had been in charge of teams of men doing some hunting and honest-to-God exploring. For the first time in this accursed expedition's 3 years of sitting around and freezing, Third Lieutenant John Irving was a true explorer. It was true that the island he was exploring eastward across, the same King William Land to which he'd come with Lieutenant Graham Gore a little more than 11 months ago, wasn't worth a drop of Chinaman's piss, what with it being all frozen gravel and low hills, none rising more than 20 or so feet above sea level, inhabited only by howling winds and pockets of deep snow, and then more frozen gravel. But Irving was exploring. Already this morning he had seen things that no other white man, and perhaps no other human being on the planet, had ever seen. Of course, it was just more low hills of frozen gravel, and more windswept pockets of ice and snow, not so much as an Arctic fox track or a mummified ringed seal to be found, but it was his discovery. Sir James Ross had sledged around the northern coast to reach Victory Point 2 decades or so ago, but it was John Irving, originally from Bristol, and then the young master of London Town, who was the first explorer of the interior of King William Land. Irving had half a mind to name the interior Irving Land. Why not? The point not far from Terra Camp was named after Sir John's wife, Lady Jane Franklin, and what had she ever done to deserve the honour except marry an old, fat, bald man? The various man-hauling teams were beginning to think of themselves as distinct groups. So yesterday, Irving led this same band of 6 men on a hunting party, while George Hodgson took his men out to reconnoitre the island, as per Captain Crozier's instructions. Irving's hunters had found not so much as an animal track in the snow. The lieutenant had to admit that since all of his men had been armed with shotguns or muskets yesterday, Irving himself had carried only a pistol in his coat pocket as he was doing today, there had been moments when he had felt some concern about the Kolka's mate Hickey being behind him and carrying a gun. But of course, nothing had happened. With Magnus Manson more than 25 miles away at the ship, Hickey was not only polite, but actually deferential to Irving, Hodgson, and the other officers. It reminded John Irving of how their tutor used to separate his brothers and him during classes at their Bristol home when the boys had become too rowdy during the long, dreary days of lessons. The tutor would actually set the boys in separate rooms in the old manor and conduct their lessons separately for hours, moving from one part of the second floor of the old wing to the next, his high-heeled, buckled shoes echoing on the ancient oak floors. John and his brothers, David and William, such a handful around Mr. Candrio when the three were together, became almost timid in front of the pale-faced, knobby-kneed beanpole of a white-wigged tutor when alone with him. Originally, very reluctant to approach Captain Crozier about leaving Manson behind, Irving was now glad he had spoken up. He was even gladder that the captain had not pressed him for a reason. Irving had never told the captain about what he had seen going on between the Kolka's mate and Big Seaman that night on the hold deck, and never would. but today there was no tension about Hickey or anything else. The only member of the scouting party to carry a weapon, other than Irving himself with his pistol, was Edwin Lawrence, who was armed with a musket. Shooting practice near the line of sledge-mounted boats at Terra Camp had shown that Lawrence was the only man in this group who could shoot a musket worth a damn, so he was their guard and protector today. The rest carried only canvas packs slung over their shoulders, jury-rigged bags hanging from one strap. Reuben Mayle, the captain of the forecastle, and an inventive type, had worked with old Murray, the sailmaker, to make up these packs for all the men, so naturally, the seamen called them mail bags. In the mail bags, they kept their lead or pewter water bottles, some biscuits and dried pork, a tin of Goldner's canned goods for emergency rations, some extra layers of clothing, the wire goggles that Crozier had ordered made up to protect them from sun blindness, extra powder and shot for when they were hunting, and their blanket sleeping bags just in case something should prevent them from returning to camp and they had to bivouac that night. This morning, they had hiked inland for more than 5 hours. The group stayed on the slight gravel rises when they could. The wind was stronger and colder there, but the walking was easier than in the snow and ice-filled swales. They had seen nothing that might enhance everyone's chance of survival, not even green lichen or orange moss growing on rock. Irving knew from reading books in Terra's great cabin library, including two books by Sir John Franklin himself, that hungry men could make a sort of soup from the scrapings of moss and lichen. Very hungry men. When his reconnoitering team had stopped for their cold dinner and water, and some much-needed rest while huddled down out of the wind, Irving had handed over temporary command to Captain of the Maintop Thomas Farr, and gone on for a while by himself. He told himself that the men were exhausted by their extraordinary sledge pulls of the past few weeks and needed the rest, but the truth was, he needed the solitude. Irving had told Farr that he would be back in an hour, and that, to make sure he did not get lost, he would frequently dip down across snowy patches out of the wind, leaving his boot tracks for himself to follow back, or for the others to use to find him if he was late returning. As he walked farther east, blissfully alone, he had chewed on a hard biscuit, feeling how loose his two teeth were. When he pulled the biscuit away from his mouth, there was blood on it. As hungry as he was, Irving had little appetite these days. He waded up through another snowfield onto frozen gravel and trudged up the rise to yet another wind-swept low ridge, then stopped suddenly. Black specks were moving in the broad, snow-swept valley ahead of him. Irving used his teeth to tug off his mittens and fumbled in his mail bag for his prized possession, the beautiful brass telescope his uncle had given him upon entering the Navy. The brass eyepiece would freeze to his cheek and brow if he allowed it to touch, so it was harder getting a steady image while holding it away from his face, even holding the long glass in both hands. His arms and hands were shaking. What he had thought to be a small herd of woolly animals turned out to be human beings. Hodgson's hunting party. No, these forms were dressed in heavy fur parkas of the sort Lady Silence wore. And there were 10 figures laboriously crossing the snowy valley, walking close together, but not in a single file line. George only had 6 men with him, and Hodgson had taken his hunting party south along the coast today, not inland. This group had a small sledge with them. Hodgson's hunting party had no sledge with them. There was not a sledge this small at Terra Camp. Irving fiddled with the focus of his beloved telescope and held his breath to keep the instrument from shaking. This sledge was being pulled by a team of at least 6 dogs. These were either white rescuers wearing Eskimo garb or actual Eskimo. Irving had to lower the telescope and then go to one knee on the cold gravel and lower his head for a moment. The horizon seemed to be spinning. The physical weakness he'd been holding back for weeks through sheer force of will welled up through him like concentric circles of nausea. "This changes everything," he thought. The figures below, they still did not appear to have seen him, probably because he had crossed over the rise and would not be very visible here, with his dark coat blending into the dark rock. Could be hunters, out from some unknown farther north Eskimo village that was not far away. If so, the 105 survivors of Erebus and Terra were almost certainly saved. The natives would either feed them or show them how to feed themselves up here in this lifeless land. Or there was a chance that the Eskimo were a war party and that the crude spears Irving had caught a glimpse of in the glass were meant for the white men they'd somehow heard had invaded their lands. Either way, Third Lieutenant John Irving knew that it was his job to go down, encounter them, and find out. He closed the telescope, set it carefully amid extra sweaters in his shoulder bag, and, throwing one arm high in what he hoped the savages would see as a gesture of greeting and peace, started down the long hill toward the 10 humans who had suddenly stopped in their tracks. Chapter 36. Crozier. Latitude 69 degrees, 37 minutes, 42 seconds north. Longitude 98 degrees, 41 minutes west. 24 April, 1848. The third and last day on the ice was by far the hardest. Crozier had made this crossing at least twice before in the last 6 weeks, with some of the earliest and larger sledge parties. But even with the trail less established, it had been much easier then. He'd been healthier, and he'd been infinitely less tired. Francis Crozier was not truly aware of it, but since his recovery from his near-fatal withdrawal illness in January, his severe melancholia had made him an insomniac. As a sailor, and then a captain, Crozier had always prided himself, as most captains did, on needing very little sleep and waking from the deepest sleep at any change in the ship's condition, a slight change in the ship's direction, the rising of wind in the sails, the sound of too many feet running on deck above him during any specific watch, any alteration in the sound of the water moving against the ship's hull, anything. But in recent weeks, Crozier slept less and less each night, until he'd fallen into the habit of only half-dozing for an hour or two in the middle of the night, perhaps catching a nap of 30 minutes or less during the day. He told himself it was just the result of so many details to watch over and commands to give in the last days and weeks before taking to the ice, but in truth, it was melancholia trying to destroy him again. His mind was sodden much of the time. He was a smart man whose mind was stupid with the chemical byproducts of constant fatigue. Sleeping at sea camps 1 and 2 had been damned near impossible for any of the men the past 2 nights, no matter how tired they were. There had been no need to erect tents at either camp since 8 Holland tents there had been left up permanently over the past weeks, any wind or snow damage being repaired by the next party that came through. The 3-person reindeer skin sleeping bags were many times warmer than the sewn-together Hudson's Bay blanket bags, and these good bags had been drawn by lottery. Crozier had not even taken part in the lottery, but when, the first time he'd been on the ice, he'd come into the tent he shared with 2 other officers, he found that his steward, Jobson, had laid out a reindeer skin bag tailored for him. Neither the ailing Jobson nor the men thought it right that their captain would have to share a bag with 2 other snoring, farting, shoving men, even other officers, and Crozier had been too tired and grateful to argue. Nor had he told Jobson or the others that sleeping in a bag by oneself was much chillier than his experience sleeping in 3 man bags. The other men's body heat was the only thing that kept them warm enough to sleep through the night. But Crozier hadn't tried to sleep through the night at either sea camp. Every 2 hours he was up and walking the perimeter to make sure that the watch had changed on time. The wind came up during the night, and the men on watch huddled behind hastily erected low snow walls. Because the biting wind and blowing snow kept the men curled low behind their snowblock barriers, the thing on the ice would have been visible to them only if it had actually stepped on one of the men. It did not make its appearance that night. During the fitful minutes of sleep he did find, Crozier was revisited by the nightmares he'd had during his January illness. Some of the dreams returned so many times, and startled the captain out of sleep so many times, that he remembered fragments of them. Teenaged girls carrying out a séance. McClintock and another man staring down into an open boat at 2 skeletons, one sitting up and fully clothed in peacoat and slops, the other just a mass of tumbled and gnawed bones.
Crozier walked through his days wondering if he was one of those skeletons. But the worst dream by far was the communion dream in which he was a boy, or a sicker, older version of himself, and was kneeling naked at the altar rail in Memo Moira's forbidden church, while the huge, inhuman priest, dripping water in shredded white vestments through which showed the raw red flesh of a badly burned man, loomed over him and leaned closer, breathing carrion breath into Crozier's uplifted face. The men all rose in the dark a little after 5 a.m. on the morning of 23 April. The sun would not rise until almost 10 a.m. The wind continued to blow, flapping the brown canvas of the Holland tents and stinging their eyes as they huddled to eat breakfast. On the ice, the men were supposed to heat their food thoroughly in small tins labeled Cooking Apparatus 1, using their small spirit stoves, fueled by pints of ether carried in bottles. Even without wind, it was often difficult, or nearly impossible, to get the spirit stoves primed and started. In a wind like that morning's, it was simply not possible, even when taking the risk of firing up the spirit stoves inside the tents. So, reassuring themselves that Goldner's canned meats and vegetables and soups had already been cooked, the men just spooned the frozen or near-frozen masses of congealed glop straight out of the cans. They were starving and had an endless day of man-hauling ahead of them. Good Sir and the three dead surgeons before Good Sir had talked to Crozier and Fitzjames about the importance of heating Goldner's tinned foodstuffs, especially the soup. The vegetables and meats, Good Sir had pointed out, had indeed been pre-cooked, but the soups, mostly cheap parsnips and carrots and other root vegetables, were concentrated, meant to be diluted with water and brought to a boil. The surgeon could not name the poisons that could be lurking in unboiled Goldner soups, and perhaps even in the meats and vegetables, but he kept reiterating the need for full heating of the tinned foods, even while on the march on the ice. These warnings were one of the main reasons Crozier and Fitzjames had ordered the heavy iron whaleboat stoves transported to Terror Camp over the ice and pressure ridges. But there were no stoves here at Sea Camp 1, or at Sea Camp 2 the next night. The men ate all the tinned foods cold from the can when the spirit stoves failed, and even when the ether of the little stoves lighted, there was just enough fuel to melt the frozen soups, not bring them to a boil. That would have to suffice, thought Crozier. As soon as breakfast was finished, the captain's belly began rumbling with hunger again. The plan had been to fold up the 8 Holland tents at both sea camps and haul them to Terror Camp on the sledges to serve as backup should the groups have to go out on the ice again soon. But the wind was too high and the men were too weary, even after just one day and night on the ice this trip. Crozier conferred with Lieutenant Little, and they decided that 3 tents would be enough to bring along from this camp. Perhaps they would do better the next morning after Sea Camp 2. 3 men in harness broke down that second day on the ice on 23 April 1848. 1 began vomiting blood onto the ice. The other 2 simply fell in their tracks and were unable to pull for the rest of that day. 1 of those 2 had to be set onto a sledge and hauled. Not wanting to reduce the number of armed pickets walking behind, ahead, and to the sides of the procession of sledges, Crozier and Little tied on harnesses and manhauled for most of that endless day. The pressure ridges weren't as high during this middle day of the crossing, and the previous sledge tracks had left a virtual highway on this stretch of open sea ice, but the wind and blowing snow eliminated almost all of these advantages. Men pulling a sledge could not see the next sledge 15 feet in front of them. The marines or sailors, carrying weapons and walking along as guards, could see no one else when they were 20 feet or more from the sledges, and had to walk within a yard or 2 of the sledge parties so as not to get lost. Their usefulness as lookouts was nil. Several times during the day, the lead sledge, usually Crozier's or Lieutenant Little's, would lose the worn sledge track, and everyone would then have to stop for up to half an hour, while some men unharnessed themselves, tied on a rope so as not to get lost in the howling snow, and walked left and right of the false route, seeking out the faint depressions of the actual track on a surface quickly being covered by inches of blowing snow. To lose the route midway like this would cost not only time, it might well cost all of them their lives.
Some of the sledge teams hauling heavier loads this spring had done this 9 miles of flat sea ice in under 12 hours, arriving at Sea Camp 2 only hours after the sun had set. Crozier's group arrived long after midnight and almost missed the camp completely. If Magnus Manson, whose keen hearing seemed as unusual as his size and low intelligence, had not heard the flapping of tents in the wind far to their port side, they would have marched past their shelter and food cache. As it was, Sea Camp 2 had been largely destroyed by the day's incessant and rising winds. 5 of the 8 tents had been blown away into the darkness, even though they had been secured by deep ice screws, or simply torn to tatters. The exhausted and starving men managed to pitch 2 of the 3 tents they'd manhauled from Sea Camp 1, and 46 men, who would have been comfortable but crowded in 8 tents, squeezed into 5. For the men taking turns on watch that night, 16 of the 46, the wind, snow, and cold were a living hell. Crozier stood one of the 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. watches. He preferred being able to move, since his one-man sleeping bag would not allow him to get warm enough to sleep anyway, even with men stacked like cordwood around him in the flapping tent. The final day on the ice was the worst. The wind had stopped shortly before the men roused themselves at 5 a.m., but, as in evil compensation for the gift of the blue skies to come, the temperature dropped at least 30 degrees. Lieutenant Little took the measurements that morning. The temperature at 6 a.m. was minus 64 degrees.
"It's only 8 miles," Crozier kept telling himself that day as he pulled in harness. He knew that the other men were thinking the same thing. "Only 8 miles today. A full mile less than yesterday's terrible haul."
With more men dropping from sickness or exhaustion, Crozier ordered the accompanying guards to stow their rifles, muskets, and shotguns on the sledges and to tie on to the harnesses as soon as the sun rose. Every man who could walk would pull. Lacking guards, they trusted in the clarity of the day. The brown blur of King William Land was visible as soon as the sun rose. The wall of high bergs and jostled coastal ice along its rim distressingly more visible, distantly gleaming in the thin, cold sunlight like a barrier of broken glass. But the clear light ensured they would not lose the old sledge tracks, and that the thing on the ice could not sneak up on them. But the thing was out there. They could see it, a small dot loping along to the southwest of them, moving much faster than they could haul. Or run, should it come to that. Several times during the day, Crozier or Little would unstrap from harness, retrieve their telescopes from the sledges or their mail bags, and look across the miles of ice at the creature. It was at least 2 miles away and moving on all fours. From this distance, it might be just another white Arctic bear of the kind they had shot and killed in such plentitude in the last 3 years, until, that is, the thing took to its hind legs, rose up above the surrounding ice blocks and minibergs, and sniffed the air as it stared in their direction.
"It knows we've abandoned the ships," thought Crozier, staring through his brass telescope that had become scuffed and scarred from so many years' use at both poles. "It knows where we're going. It's planning to get there first."
They pulled on through the day, stopping only at the mid-afternoon sunset to eat frozen chunks out of cold cans. Their rations of salt pork and stale biscuits had been used up. The ice walls separating King William Land from the pack ice glowed like a city with 10,000 burning gas lamps in the minutes before darkness spread across the sky like spilled ink. They still had 4 miles to go. 8 men were on sledges now, 3 of the seamen unconscious. They crossed the Great Ice Barrier, separating the pack ice from land sometime after 1 a.m. The wind stayed low, but the temperature continued to drop. During one pause to re-rig ropes for the lifting of the sledges over a 30-foot wall of ice, made not at all easier by the passage of sledges in weeks past since the movement of the ice had tumbled 1,000 new ice blocks into their path from the towering bergs on either side, Lieutenant Little took another temperature reading. It was minus 82 degrees. Crozier had been working and giving commands from within a deep trench of exhaustion for many hours. At sunset, when he last looked to the south at the distant creature loping ahead of them now, It was already crossing the sea ice barrier in easy leaps. He had made the mistake of taking his mittens and gloves off for a moment, so as to write some position notes in his log. He had forgotten to don the gloves before lifting the telescope again, and his fingertips and one palm had instantly frozen to the metal. In pulling his hands away quickly, he had ripped a layer of skin and some flesh off his right thumb and three fingers on that hand, and lifted a swath off his left palm. Such wounds did not heal up here in the Arctic, especially not after the early symptoms of scurvy had set in. Crozier had turned away from the others and vomited from the pain. The sickening burning in his ravaged fingers and left palm only grew worse through the long night of hauling, tugging, lifting, and pushing. His arm and shoulder muscles bruised and bled internally under the pressure of the harness straps. For a while on the last barrier, around 1:30 in the morning, with the stars and planets shimmering and shifting in the endless, clear, but murderously cold sky overhead, Crozier stupidly considered leaving all the sledges behind and making a dash for Terra Camp, still a full mile away across the frozen gravel and drifted snow. Other men could come back with them tomorrow and help fetch these impossibly heavy burdens the last mile or so. Enough of Francis Crozier's mind and command instincts remained for him to reject this thought at once. He could do just that, of course, abandon the sledges, the first party in weeks to do so, and ensure their survival by staggering across the ice to the safety of Terra Camp without their burdens, but he would lose all leadership forever in the eyes of his 104 surviving men and officers. Even though the pain from his torn hands caused him to vomit frequently and silently onto the ice wall as they pulled and pushed the sledges over, a distant part of Crozier's mind noticed that the vomitus was liquid and red in the lantern light. He continued giving orders and lending a hand as the 38 men, well enough to continue the struggle, managed to get the sledges and themselves over the barrier and onto the ice and runner-scraping gravel of the shoreline. If he hadn't been sure that the cold would rip the skin of his lips off, Crozier might have fallen to his knees in the dark and kissed the solid ground as they heard the new sound of gravel and stone protesting under the sledge runners for the final mile. There were torches burning at Terra Camp. Crozier was in the lead harness of the lead sledge as they approached. Everyone tried to stand tall, or at least stagger in an upright position, as they pulled the dead weight sledges and the unconscious men on them the last 100 yards into camp. There were men fully dressed in slops and outside the tents waiting for them. At first, Crozier was touched by their concern, sure that the 24 or so men he saw in the torchlight had been on the verge of sending out a rescue party in search of their overdue captain and comrades. As Crozier leaned into the harness, pulling the last 60 feet or so into the light from the torches, his hands and bruises aflame with pain, he prepared a little joke for their arrival, something along the lines of declaring it Christmas again and announcing that everyone would sleep the next week through. But then Captain Fitzjames and some of the other officers stepped closer to greet them. Crozier saw their eyes then. Fitzjames's eyes, and Le Vicomte's, and Deveau's, and Couch's, and Hodgson's, and Goodsir's, and the others there. And he knew, through Memo Moira's second sight, or his demonstrated captain's sense, or just through the clear, unfiltered by thought perception of a completely exhausted man, he knew that something had happened, and that nothing would now be as he had planned or hoped, and might never be again.